Welcome to A Study in Sherlock, one fan's journey into obsessive Sherlockian. Mr. Sherlock Holmes, who is usually very late in the mornings, save upon those infrequent occasions when he stayed up all night, was seated at the breakfast table. I stood upon the hearth rug and picked up the stick which our visitor had left behind him the night before. It was a fine, thick piece of wood, bulbous head of the sort which is known as a Penang lawyer. Just under the head was a broad silver band, nearly an inch across, to James Mortimer, MRCS. From your friends at the CCH was engraved upon it, with the date 1884. It was just such a stick as the old-fashioned family practitioner used to carry, dignified, solid, and reassuring. Well, Watson, what do you make of it? Holmes was sitting with his back to me, and I had given him no sign of my occupation. How did you know what I was doing? I believe you have eyes in the back of your head. I have at least a well-polished, silver-plated coffee pot in front of me, said he. But tell me, Watson, what do you make of our visitor's stick? Since we have been so unfortunate as to miss him, and have no notion of his errand, this accidental souvenir becomes of importance. Let me hear you reconstruct the man by examination of it. I think, said I, following as far as I could the methods of my companion, that Dr. Mortimer is a successful elderly medical man, well esteemed, since those who know him give him the mark of their appreciation. Good, said Holmes. Excellent. I think also that the probability is in favor of his being a country practitioner who does a great deal of his visiting on foot. Why so? Because this stick, though originally a very handsome one, may have been so knocked about that I can hardly imagine a town practitioner carrying it. The thick iron ferrule is worn down, so it is evident that he has done a great amount of walking with it. Perfectly sound, said Holmes. And then again there is the Friends of the CCH. I should guess that is something Hunt, the local Hunt, to whose members he has possibly given some surgical assistance, in which he has made him a small presentation in return. Really, Watson, you excel me, said Holmes, pushing back his hair and lighting a cigarette. I am bound to say that in all the accounts which you have been so good as to give of my own small achievements, you have habitually underrated your own abilities. It may be that you are not yourself luminous, but you are a conductor of light. Some people, without possessing genius, have a remarkable power of stimulating it. I confess, my dear fellow, that I am very much in your debt. He had never said as much before, and I must admit that his words have given me keen pleasure, for I had often been piqued by his indifference to my admiration and to the attempts which I had made to give publicity to his methods. I was proud, too, to think that I had so far mastered his system as to apply it in a way which earned his approval. He now took the stick from my hands and examined it for a few minutes with his naked eyes. Then, with an expression of interest, he laid down his cigarette and, carrying the cane to the window, he looked over it again with a convex lens. Interesting, though elementary, said he as he returned to his favorite corner of the settee. There are certainly one or two indications upon the stick. It gives us the basis for several deductions. Has anything escaped me? I asked, with some self-importance. I trust that there is nothing of consequence that I have overlooked. I am afraid, my dear Watson, that most of your conclusions were erroneous. When I said that you stimulated me, I meant, to be frank, that in noting your fallacies, I was occasionally guided towards the truth. Not that you are entirely wrong in this instance. The man is certainly a country practitioner, and he walks a good deal. Then I was right, to that extent. But that was all. No, no, my dear Watson, not all. By no means all. I would suggest, for example, that a presentation to a doctor is more likely to come from a hospital than from a hunt. And when the initials CC are in place before the hospital, the words Charing Cross very naturally suggest themselves. You may be right. The probability lies in that direction. If we take this as a working hypothesis, we have a fresh basis from which to start our construction of this unknown visitor. Well then, supposing that CCH does stand for Charing Cross Hospital, what further inferences may we draw? Do none suggest themselves? You know my methods. Apply them. I can only think of the obvious conclusion that the man has practiced in town before going to the country. I think that we might venture a little further than this. Look at it in this light. On what occasion would it be most probable that such a presentation would be made? When would his friends unite to give him a pledge of their goodwill? Obviously, at the moment when Dr. Mortimer withdrew from the service of the hospital in order to start in practice for himself. We know there has been a presentation. We believe there has been a change from a town hospital to a country practice. Is it then stretching our inference too far to say that the presentation was on the occasion of the change? It certainly seems probable. Now, you will observe that he could not have been on the staff of the hospital, since only a man well established in a London practice could hold such a position, and such a one would not drift into the country. What was he then? If he was in the hospital and yet not on the staff, he could only have been a house surgeon or a house physician, little more than a senior student. And if he left 5 years ago, the date is on the stick. So, your grave, middle-aged family practitioner vanishes in thin air, my dear Watson, and there emerges a young feller, under 30, amiable, unambitious, absent-minded, and the possessor of a favorite dog, which I should describe roughly as being larger than a terrier and smaller than a mastiff. I laughed incredulously as Sherlock Holmes leaned back into his study and blew little wavering rings of smoke up to the ceiling. As to the latter part, I have no means of checking you, said I, but at least it is not difficult to find out a few particulars about the man's age and professional career. From my small medical shelf, I took down the medical directory and turned up the name of several Mortimers, but only one that could have been our visitor. I read his record aloud. Mortimer, James, MRCS, 1882, Griffin, Dartmoor, Devon, house surgeon from 82 to 84 at Charing Cross Hospital, winner of the Jackson Prize for Comparative Pathology with an essay entitled Is Disease a Reversion? Corresponding member of the Swedish Pathology Society, author of Some Freaks of Atavism, Lancet 1882. Do We Progress? Journal of Psychology, March 1883. Medical officer for the parishes of Grimpen, Thorsley, and Highbarrow. No mention of the local hunt, Watson, said Holmes, with a mischievous smile, but a country doctor, as you very astutely observed. I think that I am fairly justified in my inferences. As to the adjectives, I said, if I remember right, amiable, unambitious, and absent-minded. It is my experience that it is only an amiable man in this world who receives testimonials, only an unambitious one who abandons a London career for the country, and only an absent-minded one who leaves his stick and not his visiting card after waiting an hour in your room. And the dog has been in the habit of carrying his stick behind his master. Being a heavy stick, the dog has held it tightly in by the middle, and the marks on his teeth are very plainly visible. The dog's jaw has shown in the space between these marks, too broad in my opinion for a terrier, and not broad enough for a mastiff. It may have been, yes, by Jove, it's a curly-haired spaniel. He had arisen and paced the room as he spoke. Now he halted in the recess of the window. There was such a ringing of conviction in his voice that I glanced up in surprise. "My dear fellow, how can you possibly be sure of that?" "For the very simple reason that I see the dog himself on our doorstep, and there is the ring of the owner." "Don't move, I beg you, Watson. He is a professional brother of yours, and your presence may be of assistance to me." "Now is the dramatic moment of fate, Watson. When you hear a step upon the stair which is walking into your life, and you know whether or not for good or ill, what does Dr. James Mortimer, the man of science, ask of Sherlock Holmes, the specialist in crime? Come in." The appearance of our visitor was a surprise to me, since I had expected a typical country practitioner. He was a very tall, thin man, and a long nose like a beak, which shot out between two keen gray eyes set closely together and sparkling brightly from behind a pair of gold-rimmed glasses. He was clad in a professional but rather slovenly fashion, for his frock coat was dingy and his trousers frayed. Though young, his long back was already bowed, and he walked with a forward thrust of his head and a gentle air of peering benevolence. As he entered, his eyes fell upon the stick in Holmes's hand, and he ran towards it with an exclamation of joy. "I'm so very glad," said he. "I was not sure whether I had left it here or in the shipping office. I would not lose that stick for the world." "A presentation, I see," said Holmes. "Yes, sir." "From Charing Cross Hospital?" "From one or two friends there on the occasion of my marriage." "Dear, dear, that's bad," said Holmes, shaking his head. Dr. Mortimer blinked through his glasses in mild astonishment. "Why was it bad?" "Only that you have disarranged our little deductions. Your marriage, you say?" "Yes, sir, I married and so left the hospital, and with it all hopes of a consulting practice. It was necessary to make a home of my own." Come, come, we are not so far wrong after all," said Holmes. "And now, Dr. James Mortimer, Mr. a humble MRCS, and a man of precise mind, evidently. A dabbler in science, Mr. Holmes, a picker up of shells on the shore of the great unknown ocean. I presume that it is Mr. Sherlock Holmes who I'm addressing and not..." "No, this is my friend, Dr. Watson. Glad to meet you, sir. I've heard your name mentioned in connection with that of your friend. You interest me very much, Mr. Holmes, and I had hardly expected so dolly Sherlock definitely feel it. I had hardly expected so dolly slothlockic a scholar, such well-marked supra-orbital development. Would you have any objection to my running my fingers along your parietal fissure? A cast of your skull, sir, until the original is available, would be an ornament to any anthropological museum. It is not my intention to be fulsome, but I confess I can covet your skull. Sherlock Holmes waved his strange visitor into a chair. You're enthusiastic in your line of thought, I perceive, sir, as I am in mine, said he. I observe from your forefinger that you make your own cigarettes. Have no hesitation in lighting one. The man drew out paper and tobacco, twirled the one up in the other with surprising dexterity. He had long, quivering fingers, his edge on restless as the antenna of an insect. Holmes was silent, but his little dirty glances showed me the interest which he took in our curious companion. I presume, sir, said he at last, that it is not merely for the purpose of examining my skull that you have done me the honor to call here last night and again today. No, sir, no, though I am happy to have had the opportunity of doing that as well. I came to you, Mr. Holmes, because I recognize that I am myself an unpractical man, and because I suddenly confronted with a most serious and extraordinary problem, recognizing as I do that you are the second highest expert in Europe. Indeed, sir, may I inquire who has the honor to be the first? Asked Holmes with some asperity. To the man of precisely scientific mind, the work of Monsignor Bartholomew. Must always appeal strongly. Then had you not better consult him? I said, sir, to the precisely scientific man, but as a practical man of affairs, it is acknowledged that you stand alone. I trust, sir, that I have not inadvertently, just a little, said Holmes. I think, Dr. Mortimer, you would do wisely if, without much ado, you would kindly tell me plainly what the exact nature of the problem is in which you demand my assistance. That was chapter one of The Hound of the Baskervilles, named Mr. Sherlock Holmes, by Arthur Conan Doyle. It was narrated by myself, Bruce McIntosh, and it was originally published in the Strand Magazine, going from August of 1901 till April of 1902. And then they published it in a novel form in the same year, 1902. It became the most popular Sherlock Holmes stories of all time. It's been made, adapted for television and movies over 20 times. Many times it's been adapted for the radio. So you could probably find some of the radio broadcasts if there are some Sherlock Holmes podcasts. There's audiobooks. I've recently, the Clive Merriman ones. I haven't listened to his Hound of the Baskervilles one, but that is definitely on my list. I've seen several of the adaptations of it. 1939, Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce starred in it, which started the Basil Rathbone movie series. And No, 1959, Peter Cushing would star as Sherlock Holmes in The Hound of the Baskervilles. He would also actually go on to, in 1968, to star in a show with the same name. So it was he got to do it twice as Sherlock Holmes in Hound of the Baskervilles. The storyline concerned Sir Henry Baskerville was returning to his ancestral home, and there was the curse of the Baskervilles, where there was a legend about a giant hound killing people. It is a tale much, you know, there's a lot about it for Sherlockians and Norton, and even if you're not a Sherlockian, to like about it. Supernatural effect, the gothic, the classic detective novel. Of course, Holmes and Watson, this is some of the best Holmes and Watson stories. And Holmes actually played a bigger part in this one than in many of the other stories, where he's normally just there. He became a very important part of this story. Originally, Sherlock Holmes had said he was too busy to go, and I'm going to send Watson in my place. It was more so he could do some investigating on the side. So I think that was a little bit different take on the whole Holmes and Watson take. So sent him there, and he was sending correspondences to Holmes for him to be up to date on everything going on there. I said it was... And at this time, one thing that was going on was 8 years previously in 1891. Yes, it was 1891, and he started... must have my number, date wrong. In 1903, I'm sorry. But he would... excuse me. Holmes had actually died in 1891 in the final problem. Now, after that, there would be the long hiatus. According to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, had killed him off in that, and really did not want to make any more Sherlock Holmes novels. But due to fan pressure or thing, because Strand Magazine definitely would want more, they lost many, many sales and subscribers when Holmes was killed off. When he brought him back for this tale, that he made a point to know, let the public know that this story was taking place before the events in the final problems, where he was killed at Reichenbach Falls. So they went on. He would actually come back and start making more stories in 1903. Bring him back. Explaining that he had faked his death and went out a month get taken care of Professor Moriarty's criminal organization at the time. Now, all this is going on. So, he put out this story, and it's become the number one Sherlock Holmes story, and many famous for many reasons. One thing, when they were putting them out monthly, if you look, read the chapters one at a time, a lot of the chapters kept the reader waiting for the next one. There was some sort of little cliffhanger or something at the end. The first part of it ended with exchange between Holmes and Dr. Mortimer, went like this. Footprints? Footprints. A man or a woman's? Dr. Mortimer looked strangely at us for an instant, and his voice sank almost to a whisper as he answered, "Mr. Holmes, they were the footprints of a gigantic hound." And luckily, during all these publications of these, you know, like I said, Strand Magazine went up, and I mentioned earlier, there was many adaptations of this for the movies and television. I mean, they had started way back in 19, I believe the first one was 1914. Some of the problems one, Robert Rendell in 1931 was playing Holmes. One of them, as one of the most popular, which started with one of the most famous actors. Well, he's famous for playing Holmes, Basil Rathbone. And what's funny, I thought it was funny when I read that he actually wasn't the number one name on the billboard. It was Richard Green, who was playing Sir Henry Baskerville. So that was the only time in a Sherlock Holmes movie Basil Rathbone played second fiddle to anybody. Well, I guess in Sherlock Holmes we should be saying second violin. But, and it would be, and they would film this over in America, and I just, hold on 1 second here. Yes, I had to get it real quick. If you get the Sherlock Holmes magazine, they just started this last year in 2020. They're only on issue 3 currently. This one has Enola Holmes, the actor that played her. About her, and Henry Cavill has Sherlock Holmes. Now it's going to bug me that I can't recall her name. I wasn't even expecting to be talking about her. If you didn't see Enola Holmes, that's a whole other story. We'll have to talk about that sometimes, but I actually enjoyed that movie too. But back to Sue the Hound of the Baskervilles. But there's been that article in here about Basil Rathbone, excerpt from his new book. Basil Rathbone biographer David Clayton tells the story of the career-defining 1939 adaptation of The Hound of the Baskervilles. And they had a nice article about them making that movie and how Rathbone was their number one pick to play Sherlock at that time. I do plan on doing more in-depth about Basil in the near future. But this was one of the films, and how they filmed it in a studio in California, and they built all these sets and had fog put in so they can get that effect on the that you would see at the in the movie. And it was in black and white back then, and which really helped get that effect they wanted. In 1959, they had another version. I did see this one also. I haven't seen them all yet. I guess I better get my Hound of the Baskervilles watching done. It was actually the Hound of Baskerville in 1959. Starred Peter Cushing as Sherlock Holmes. Andre Morel has Dr. Watson. It had Christopher Lee in. It has Sir Henry Baskerville. And Ewan Sullen has Stapleton. Now, this is actually the first Holmes movie ever released in color, produced by Hammer Films. And they had a little bit more of the scared out. A lot of the people that were involved with this were actually involved with more horror movies. So I guess that was one reason they wanted to go with The Hound of Baskervilles. And, there's been others since. Let's see, in 1972, Barry Crane cast Stuart Granger as Holmes, and Bernard Fox as Watson. It was a made-for-television film broadcast in the United States on ABC. That was 1972. And, let's see, it went out 1983. Ian Richardson has Holmes, and Donald Churchill has Watson. The Granada TV series starring Jeremy Brett with Edward Hardwick has the, has Dr. Watson. Man, sometimes you got it right there you're thinking about. Was a made-for-TV film with the Granada TV series, and was put on with they did a version of that. That show had been on for a while, so that was during their second season with the return of Sherlock Holmes. The Granada series virtually, you know, if you're going to do a television series or anything, you have to have some sort of reference or do your take on the Hound of the Baskervilles. Sherlock, with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman in the starring roles, would actually do one called The Hounds of the Baskerville. And they actually didn't have a real hound in that one. I haven't seen that one in a while. I did see that one. So they did do it. And I am wondering if they do very many more with Robert Downey Jr. playing Sherlock Holmes and Jude Law as Dr. Watson, if they're going to do their take on the Hound of the Baskervilles. I'm trying to think if there was anyone that I was thinking of that I didn't mention, but if you've done a series, I think a serious sort of take on the Hound, Sherlock Holmes, I think this is almost mandatory. One of the greatest stories of all time. I think if you talk to somebody that doesn't know him very much, or minor, if they've heard of Sherlock Holmes but may not know everything about him, as many Sherlockians, almost everybody's heard of the Hound of the Baskervilles. So, and the Moors and everything. So that would be one way to get somebody, since it is the most popular story in the canon and has been told many times. It's still very good. I really think even the 1939 version with Basil Rathbone held up very well. And it could be, and if you want, if they prefer novels over short stories, if you were introducing it to somebody, mine actually isn't that bad to read, because you can just, you know, knock out a chapter at a time, but it does draw you in, and I think it still holds up. I mean, some of the popularity when it first came out, the public so much missed Sherlock Holmes that they wanted it back. And when it did, they did get a chance to have it return. So, probably helped the popularity at that time. But it was a really good story and had many things in it. Very enjoyable movie. Of course, after you've seen enough versions of it, you'll probably know the story by heart. But there's, like I said, a lot of them take it from different takes. Like I said, there's been many takes of Sherlock Holmes and the Hound of the Baskerville. It's been the most adapted, whether it's for television, radio, and movies. And so, if you're a Sherlock fan and you have not seen Hound of the Baskerville, I'm actually not sure how you have not seen an adaptation of it. And it is the number one selling. I better check on that. I know it's the top novel, but as far as selling, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes is probably pretty high up there also. So, but the number one story has always been, and it's a very influential novel. It's rated one of the 100 best novel or influential or something like that of all time. So, all right. Well, thank you for listening.
Unexplained. He could not hope to frighten Sir Henry to death, as he had done the old uncle with his bogey hound. The beast was savage and half-starved. If its appearance did not frighten its victim to death, at least it would paralyze the resistance which might be offered. No doubt. There only remains one difficulty. If Stapleton came into the succession, how could he explain the fact that he, the heir, had been living unannounced under another name so close to the property? How could he claim it without causing suspicion and inquiry? It is a formidable difficulty, and I fear that you ask too much when you expect me to solve it. The past and the present are within the field of my inquiry. But what a man may do in the future is a hard question to answer. Mrs. Stapleton has heard her husband discuss the problem on several occasions. There were three possible courses. He might claim the property from South America, establish his identity before the British authorities there, and so obtain the fortune without ever coming to England at all. Or he might adopt an elaborate disguise during the short time that he need be in London. Or again, he might furnish an accomplice with the proofs and papers, putting him in as heir, and retaining a claim upon some proportion of his income. We cannot doubt, from what we know of him, that he would have found some way out of the difficulty. And now, my dear Watson, we have had some weeks of severe work, and for one evening, I think, we may turn our thoughts into more pleasant channels. I have a box for Les Huguenots. Have you heard the Dureshkis? Might I trouble you, then, to be ready in half an hour, and we can stop at Marcini's for a little dinner on the way.